Texas Trinity problem is way out of hand. The Baltimore County School Board have decided to expel Dexter from the entire public school system.
Well, Mr. Kirk, I'm as upset as you to learn Dexter's truancy. But surely expulsion is not the answer.
I'm afraid expulsion is the only answer. It's the opinion of the entire staff that Dexter is criminally insane.
That boy needs therapy.
You're psychosomatic.
That boy needs therapy.
You're lying down on the couch.
Well, what does that mean?
You're a nut. You're crazy in the coconut.
What does that mean?
That boy needs therapy.
I'm gonna kill you.
That boy needs therapy.
Brannigazoo, let's have it, you. I want to count three.
That boy needs therapy.
He was white as a sheep.
And he also made false teeth.
This is Comics Therapy episode 47, no reviews, just analysis. Up this week, two comics from June 18th, 2014, Translucid number 3 and Sex Criminals number 6. As always, we have your nerd confessions, and on the couch we talked with cartoonist and artist and Andrea's new favorite person, Jen Vaughn. Just as a reminder, we never do reviews, but we do talk a lot, so there may be spoilers ahead.
Yeah, so which character in comics would most benefit from therapy? I can only think of one. That would have to be Forever from Lazarus. I mean, you're built as a weapon, and that family has issues. Who wouldn't need therapy in those situations?
Welcome to Comics Therapy. Neither Aaron nor I are licensed therapists, so don't take anything we say as serious medical advice. That has probably never been more true than this week, because we're looking at characters battling internal demons, specifically in the form of mental illness. Shit's about to get real, y'all. There's such a stigma in our culture when it comes to talking about this kind of stuff, and even more so when it comes to admitting it's something you've dealt with personally. Comics and movies, books, television, art in general, they give us a chance to be honest under the guise of storytelling. Something happens, though, when that raw truth is recognizable and relatable under the fictional glaze. It's beautiful and scary and awesome. Comics. Good job this week making us think.
Hey, Comics Therapy. The obvious choices are superhero vigilantes such as Batman and Spider-Man, as well as their villains. I mean, come on. Scarecrow, Electro, their costumes alone back in a session at Arkham or Ravencroft. But really, the true character who would actually benefit from sitting with a psychological expert is probably Longshot. If you can make sense of whatever the hell it was that happened, his son is his dad, apparently. The son he has with Dazzler Shatterstar is his father. I would need a sit down in a long discussion after getting that news. Also, Squirrel Girl, because talking to squirrels is a sign of a serious problem. Thanks, Ty.
In between comic segments, your very own nerd confessions, celebrating what we love, for the most part, about comics. This week, we asked your thoughts on which character from comics would most benefit from counseling or therapy. It was very meta. And my idea. You can call, Skype, or email your confessions to us. The details are on the website, comicstherapy.com. Remember, catharsis is cool.
That was a trap that I set for you that you actually got yourself out of.
Yeah, I can read.
Well done.
I smart.
Huh. In between shows, you can find me on Twitter at Andrea Schock and Aaron at Aaron Myers. The show account is at Comics Therapy. How was your week, Myers?
I am working off of very little sleep, so it's actually pretty amazing I was able to read those sections or maybe carry on a conversation for like 40 minutes with you today.
This is going to be epic.
Hmm.
Very excited about talking to somebody who is sleep deprived about mental illness. It's going to be great.
Yep. If I start hallucinating, that'll really add to the show.
What is it? Just work or kids or both?
No, just kids.
Kids.
Not sleeping. Nobody wants to hear, you know, Dadcast, but God damn it, I'm tired.
Except for all the dads out there who can totally relate.
Sure. Yeah, I think with the seasons changing, it's harder to get to sleep, and I would like my kids to sleep 20 hours a day now.
You don't want kids then, you want cats.
Well, some days, maybe, yeah. that's a fair trade.
Yeah, or, they're furry.
At least like some sort of like, you know, that's a good website to make.
What? Replace family pictures of, you know, parents and kids with parents with cats?
No. People have cats. People have kids. Maybe you get tired. One gets tired of the other. You do a swap for a weekend or something. You know, like whatever that show was, you know, like wife swap or
except
something,
with kids,
you know?
And cats.
Yeah. Like, here, I'll take your cats for the weekend. Mm. You take my kids. And then we'll all appreciate what we have after a couple of days.
What happens if you don't want to give the cat back?
That is probably likely. I think it'd be more, what if you don't want the kid back?
Well, same.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's why you have checkboxes on user agreements.
So that you have to give the kid back and you have to give the cat back, and that at the end of the day, everybody ends up with who they're supposed to have?
No, like, that's why KidList is not responsible for any failed transactions after the, or CatList. It's still a working title.
Gotcha.
I haven't quite figured out what I'm going to call it.
But you've already got both domain names just in case.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Right.
You can cover your bases.
You're so good at the internet.
I am hella good at the internet.
Hmm.
Tell me about your week.
I had a good week.
Yeah? Anything happen?
Nothing of note.
Nothing important?
No.
Okay, good.
Pretty much standard operating procedures.
Good.
Yeah.
How old are you now?
I am 35.
Ugh, so old.
I know. That just happened. There was like
this
a
week?
Day that was marked.
I think you had kind of mentioned something in
Did
passing
I?
Last
I wasn't
week.
Sure if I had brought it up with you or not.
Yeah. No, it was just like in passing.
Yeah, it's not really a big deal.
Mm-hmm. Well, did you like my present I got for you?
Yeah, it was awesome. Thank you.
Good. You're welcome.
It really means a lot that you were willing to go to such lengths.
I wished you a happy birthday on both Facebook and Twitter.
I know. From the bottom of your heart. I felt it all the way
here. I was
here.
Very excited.
Yep.
For you.
Mm-hmm.
I am I don't like gift giving on holidays,
yeah,
like mandatory gift giving.
You've explained this before. I think it's bullshit, but like, I'm not your wife. Whatever, dude.
But you should be inspired to give a gift.
Right.
Not terrified to not give a gift.
I completely agree with that. I think that obligatory gift giving is not a good precedent to send. Yeah.
So... Okay, so you're not mad at me then?
No. Dude, I'm
but
never
there,
mad at
there
you.
Will be there will be repercussions.
For what?
For my failure to.
No.
Properly celebrate your birthday.
No. 100% of my birthday celebration was, you know, a joke for the internet. It's all good.
Thank you.
We're fine. You're my favorite. Everybody
I don't
is...
believe any of this. I don't trust it. You feel like a trap.
No. Everybody is happy. It's a good week.
All right. I'm just going to continue my life assuming that you're being truthful and just... It's like being a marked man. You know, you just kind of go your day by day. And just one day, somebody's going to step up behind you and, you know, wrap a piano wire around your neck.
No, that's not my MO at all.
Not, or is it?
See, I play the long con, right?
You really do.
No, this is a good segue because we're introducing a new segment. And it's called... Regression therapy. It's a bit of an editor's note, if you will. It's a chance for us, mostly me, to share some of the things that have come up in response to the previous week's conversation. It's not exactly a mea culpa, but sometimes after the show goes up, the discussion continues. You guys weigh in. Wonder of wonders, miracle of miracles. I actually appreciate the insight and the context. So this gives us, again, mostly me, a chance to go on record when applicable.
I like this. So after the show goes up, then people tell you how wrong you were, and and then we have this now.
Yes. Now we have this.
This is perfect.
So it's my birthday gift to you, Myers.
Thank you.
Yep. I've been thinking a lot about Dave, which we talked about 2 weeks ago, and that's because you're a robot from last week. And I've had a bunch of chats about the humor in both of those books. Here is my going on record. To clarify, I guess, something that came about during those conversations, which was that Roderick Ruth pointed out the similarities in humor, content, style, tone, etc., with That's Because You're a Robot and two shows from the Cartoon Network Adult Swim, C-Lab 2020 and Aqua Teen Hunger Force, which I'm a huge fucking fan of. Like, overwhelmingly, all of those older Adult Swim shows are my jam. And so I was thinking about why that is compared to reading it. And I was thinking a lot about the difference for me about the way I appreciate humor aurally versus visually.
Okay.
And I think a lot of it has to do with the presentation of that humor in like a show versus me reading it on the page.
Like the sarcasm and the absurdity, because you can hear it, it's easier and triggers in a better way for you?
Yeah, I think so. I think that in some ways that is a more like complete package for me to like immerse myself in enjoying that tone. And maybe I am more resistant to it or like less able to actually conjure that up when I'm reading it myself. Or like I think I said last week, it's very different in tone from a lot of the other things that I have been reading. So if I had been watching it, it wouldn't have been so difficult for me to buy into it. But reading it, like I was too inside myself. And so I didn't hear it accurately as much as I think I would have, or as much as I know that I did in examples like from Adult Swim. So I thought that was a really excellent analogy that I wanted to give props to and I wanted to share because it helped me rethink the way that I had been approaching those books more recently. And I don't know, maybe a little bit get the stick out of my ass so that it doesn't have to always be like a serious academic conversation about the fucking content. It can just be for fun.
Right. Sometimes comics are fun.
Sometimes they are. Mm-hmm. So there you go.
Not this week, but sometimes.
Yeah. And then in contrast, this week, not so fun.
That's fine. Good discussion.
But next week, we can talk about all the things I get wrong. I mean, all the things that have been reframed for me after the show goes up.
This is how we learn, Andrea.
I know.
Now you're a little bit older, a little bit wiser.
Yeah.
You see your faults. You're willing to admit your mistakes.
I am.
You add to your enemies list daily.
Mm-hmm.
You bide your time.
I've amassed quite a collection of people willing to help me hide the bodies.
Mm-hmm.
So well, that's I what think the I'm in pretty good shape.
Yeah, the internet's good for a lot of things.
It is. Gosh.
It's good for doing podcasts. You want to talk about some comics?
Yeah, let's do it.
Hi, Andrea Necrodamus. This is Cameron Williams, Wasgo on Twitter. And I think the character that most needs therapy is Rom. I mean, clearly Rom is having an identity crisis. Does he self-identify as a robot, or doesn't he? Plus, he's not even allowed to exist now. That must be terrible for your psyche. Have a great week.
Our first book this week is Translucent No. 3, written and created by Claudio Sanchez and Chandra Eckert, illustrated by Daniel Bayliss, and colored by Adam Metcalf, and lettered by Ed Dukeshire. Translucid is published by Boom Studios. That was pretty good, right?
It was good.
That was like an 80% for normal people. That was like a 95% for me.
What, are you grading yourself on a curve?
Well, yeah. Look at we have a historical record to go back to.
Okay, let's look at the solicit. The Navigator, New York City's only superhero, has been slipping. Could the secret be found in his childhood? Boy genius Cornelius is creating the holographic technology that allows him to become the Navigator. But what dark family secret drives him? I don't know, Aaron. I feel like I'm reading an incredibly different book than that description. To me, Translucid is the story about the way a young boy deals with his fractured, abusive home life, how he uses fantasy to escape his tragic reality, and how this vivid disassociation itself, it could be like the symptom of something far more insidious going on inside his head. I don't think it's a superhero story in the traditional sense at all. And that's what makes the character journey so incredible.
Yeah, there's identifiable tropes, which, you know, I think some people kind of groan when it's like, oh, well, this is a Batman story.
Or this is another way of looking at a superhero story, blah, blah. But the twist,
right? That's not what this is. No.
No.
Which is what I really like about it.
Right.
And it's almost like the interplay between, you know, the Navigator and the horse villain character. Yes, it could be in his head, but it's almost like that's a separate real-time sort of breakdown, and then the kid's real life is this, you know, tragedy unfolding, and it's not very linear to me in this narrative.
Agreed. It's not very linear, and so I think that, and we were talking about this before we started recording, that it seems possible that Aaron and I have two different interpretations of this. I think there's one of two things going on here. The playing with time is literally, we're seeing Cornelius as an adult is the Navigator. That's a huge leap for me, because that actually takes it from kind of a reality-based story of a child who's disassociating from his own very terrible world, and then actually creating a superhero world on top of that. But okay, what I am intrigued by is the notion that it's actually all inside of Cornelius's head. And I think that there are some clues to that. We see him designing the Navigator's helmet. We see him designing the tools that then show up later. But if you're looking at it as two different timelines, or just, you know, past and future, whatever, that's fine. You can't deny the fact that there's one more layer, and that's the fact that Cornelius is hallucinating. He's, like, actually losing his grip on reality in his real, actual life. And that hasn't shown up later at all. That's why I think the entire thing is just a layer upon a layer of reality displacement. Like, I think this kid is, you know, dealing with really shitty kid things and has separated from reality to such an extent, has, like, found solace in fantasy to such an extent that, like, mentally he's losing his grip on what is actually happening for real.
I think there's a high likelihood that you could be right. I think I could see this going now. And I think it's nice that we're only kind of like halfway kind of emerged, you know, into this. So what if we're looking at the past, we're looking at Cornelius, who we would assume becomes the Navigator, or in his mind, both of these characters exist. But instead, and this is a spoiler, his brother dies, and he becomes the horse.
Oh, Aaron. Oh, I like that.
I don't know if that's what's going to happen.
I don't either.
At the end of this, I'm like, oh, this is the, he was, you know, and maybe the Navigator is real, you know, in the future. The horse creates the Navigator, you know, he taps someone to be this hero, because that's the hero he was going to be before his world was destroyed.
Wow.
And now his job is to constantly torture the Navigator, because it's who he should have been. Had the world not, you know, done what it did to him.
Yeah, it's such a tragic story. I mean, because we've got this kid at the, like, crossroads of all of these. It's got a bunch of those tropey things happening in it. But still, they work for a reason. And watching a kid lose his grip on reality is way more effective in some cases. Because it's just like an extra layer of heartbreak. He doesn't have the worldview or the perspective to understand what's happening in real life, much less in the kind of fantasy life that he experiences sometimes when he's, like, walking down the street and he starts to hallucinate, or there's that moment when he looks in the cab and the horse is driving.
Mm-hmm.
And he's freaked out. And he tries to explain to his mother that he's, like, seeing things. And he's a really smart kid. He knows that there's something going on in his head that he doesn't have control over. And I think that more than anything else, is what makes this story work. Because he's like, so much more unique as an unreliable narrator because of his age. And I think any of the interpretations that we just listed could work, or something completely different. Like, I'm really digging not knowing where this is going to go.
Right, because to me, then the third possibility is that the navigator and the horse are playing out simultaneously. They are separate people from Cornelius. But what we're looking at is the cycle, this cycle that mm-hmm. will keep playing itself out. That there will always be, it's like these eternal characters, mm-hmm. that there will always be a horse, and there will always be a navigator, and they'll always, be working against each other.
Right.
So he is just the next one, and he could be one or the other.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's sort of beautiful.
So, right now, I don't know, let's just stop reading it, because it could go anywhere for now.
No, I think a lot of possibilities. I do want to say that more I hope more people pick it up, because I'd actually love, speaking of continuing the conversation, I'd love to talk to more people about their interpretation of the story, like, before it gets deeper into it. Because I think the playing with what's in his head and what isn't in his head can be read in so many different ways right now, and it's good stuff.
Yep. And just on a reviewy side note, too, the art is awesome. Like, it's a good-looking book.
It's
very compelling. So that's my review portion of it.
I don't do we do that? I don't think we do that.
No, we do it sometimes when I feel like talking about it.
So now you get to make the rules.
Yep, it's my show. It's my rules. I own 51%.
Here we go again.
Yep. You want to talk about another book?
Yeah.
Doom does not need therapy, and how dare you insinuate otherwise. The one who needs therapy is that intolerable tool, Richards, constantly prattling on about, "Ooh, I'm the smartest man in the world. I can build an ultimate nullifier. Check out my bendy arms. Shut up, you insolent cur." Doom out.
Our second book this week is Sex Criminals No. 6 by Matt Fraction and Chip Zdarsky. Sex Criminals is published by Image Comics. See, that was an easy one.
Yes. So the solicit for this issue frames Sex Criminals as a relationship tale. I don't disagree. But it's never going to be just a love story. Even removing the science fiction-y elements, which we basically do this time around, what we now have is a much more complete view of John than we've ever seen before. And he's struggling. He's impulsive. He's intense. He's detaching from his own contrived reality. I'm not going to say that he wants to get caught slipping like he is, because I've been there. And you don't ever want to get caught, but you need it. You need help because you can't help yourself. And you certainly just can't ask for it. So this issue is really John's story of the consequences of that slippage. And one possible attempt at a reset. He's on meds, so there's no more impulsivity issues, bad or good, and no more feelings. Everything is just fine, until it isn't.
Yeah, this is a heavy issue.
No shit.
Like, after last issue, I'm like, okay, well, where is there left to go with this, you know? And we've got a lot of places to go, and I was not expecting this. And when you're done reading it, it makes sense that this is where the story should go, and this is the real kind of now I feel like we're in the real story in a way.
Oh yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Because it's not about science fiction or people having sex and making funny jokes about time stopping and that sort of thing, which I think had a lot of good discussion stuff with it, but mm-hmm. this is more like, okay, the honeymoon's over. Now a couple has to deal with their real problems.
Mm-hmm. And these are problems that the time stopping is just a sort of side bar too.
Yeah.
That the way that John took advantage of that talent, if you will, to like manifest his impulsivity issues and his risk taking and like his need for that, with the shitting in his boss's plant, for example, has nothing to do with the fact that like actually what's going on in his head is like he's not in control. Yeah. And there's so much in his inner monologue in this book, in this issue, that wow, this was a hard and beautiful book for me to get through. I can relate so much to John's like honesty in this book and the mm-hmm. way that he describes, it's not even rock bottom, because like, let's be honest, he doesn't actually get to the point where he's like, she prevents him, Susie prevents him from getting all the way to rock bottom.
Yeah.
But like, he's lying about going to the doctor. I get it. I've done that many times. And that codependency that they have of not engaging, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Totally been there. And that, I think that, that like trust that Fraction has in his readership to jump from the kitschy humor that was so in your face in the previous books to now, this is so raw. I don't know. I really dig it. But I also, just in talking with other people, know that there are readers who are not like who are not engaging with it at that level. That like it's still funny for them. And so it makes me wonder if you don't have any kind of personal relationship with mental illness, if like you can read it just for entertainment's sake and it's just like another character trait.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. To me, I'm plenty mentally disturbed, so I identify with this, you know, just fine. So it's hard for me to imagine not clicking or empathizing with it on those levels.
Right.
Like with this issue, to me, it's like, this is the make or break issue for people who, if you wanted the story that was the first five,
mm-hmm.
then it's not that story anymore.
Yeah, it's evolving into a... This issue is so much John's story as opposed to Susie's.
Yeah. Or do we get Susie's next?
Well, yeah, honestly. I wonder how much of Susie's story... It could... Man, I'm just thinking about this now, like the way that the ending of this issue is set up. She can be reduced to a damsel in distress pretty quickly. I don't think that's what will happen. But he's such an... He is such a potentially anti-hero kind of guy right now because he's coming from such a bad place.
Yeah.
He's
self-destructive. He's depressed.
Absolutely. And the choice to go on medication to curb the like impulse issues has all of the very real side effects of like the lack of sex drive and the sort of disassociation from any real emotions, but with the people around him, like that's what makes him quote unquote normal.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so how do you break out of that again, you know, other than going off your meds?
Well, isn't that like what schizophrenics and, bipolar people, like they hate their medication because it evens them out, but then they don't feel like human anymore. And often they feel good when they're in their manic states or their schizophrenic states.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they don't realize, you don't realize your insanity because it's sort of, it is your off balance normal. And medication just kind of keeps it pushed down, but it doesn't actually fix things.
Hmm. I mean, I have very mixed responses to that, because I think, not coming from the perspective of schizophrenia or bipolar disorder, but from the perspective of, you know, a handful of other mental illnesses and various medication attempts to curb some of the more destructive symptoms,
mm-hmm.
the relationship between being aware of how you are in control on and off your medication is like a very personal one. And it's the same as like your relationship with therapy is a very personal one. And you can substitute meds and therapy with other things in your life, exercise and eating right and blah, blah, blah. But it's if there's actually a chemical imbalance there that you can correct with chemistry, mm-hmm. it's hard to make the argument that that isn't a step in the right direction. You just have to get the chemistry right so that it doesn't totally fuck up everything else that you enjoy in your life.
But isn't that the hard part?
It's very hard. It's incredibly difficult. And it takes a tremendous amount of investment of like time and other resources. John isn't at that point right now. Like he's not in balance. Like that's the whole point, is that he's lost himself just to fix like the most present manifestation of his like ADHD.
Yeah.
And great. So at the cost of the rest of the things that make him him, he's not shitting in his boss's plant anymore. Whoopie-doo.
Well, he's also not getting fired or arrested, you know.
Correct.
Or losing his house or living on the streets, so.
Right, but is he engaged with his life anymore?
Not nearly the same level. I don't know. That's the question.
Right.
That if your medications require that you lose some of yourself, but if the natural state of yourself destroys you and those around you, is that a sacrifice you have to make?
It's a very personal decision.
Well, but who makes it? That's the other question.
I think you as an individual have the right to make that decision with the guidance of professionals who can help you weigh the options and work through the options. And like, I'm not saying it's in fact, I'm
no,
saying
no,
the opposite.
I agree with
it's
you. I'm really
easy...
just, I'm trying to parse it out because it's a, okay, you should be able to make the decision, but at the same time, like society and the medical community and everything else are saying, well, you can't make that decision until you're, you know, properly medicated, because right now you can't. And it's just like this loop that kind of goes back and forth. And
yeah.
I think that's, you know, that's the frustration with it.
Dude, the system is super broken.
Yeah.
And the fact that nobody really wants to talk about it just kind of perpetuates it.
Well, because mental health is not the same as having a cut on your arm. You know,
right. It's very individual.
It's very individual, and it's sort of taboo in a lot of ways.
Yeah, no, that's exactly my point, is that nobody is comfortable talking about this kind of broken.
Yeah. And no, I know. I personally am not.
You're not, what, comfortable or broken?
Well, broken in different ways, sure. But, no, it's just very hard for me to talk about because I have personal connection to this.
Right.
And so it, you know, brings out a lot of things, and it travels down to you and then to your children. You know, it becomes a hard cycle to figure out because mm-hmm. it doesn't make sense, because it's the definition of insanity.
Well, right.
Right? Insanity doesn't make sense because it's insane.
Yeah, but okay, fair enough. I think that when you see it in art, and I guess I'm using that word to encompass like all of the different types of media that we mentioned earlier, and when you see the perspective that we obviously get with John, like there's no way for me to read this as anything other than, and Fraction has said that, but like, This is somebody telling parts of his own story in this character.
Yeah, and he's put plenty of this up to like,
sure.
It's not...
Sure, that's not conjecture, and I'm not presenting it as anything other than out of his own mouth.
Yeah.
But then, you know, as somebody who has gone through similar experiences myself, like I cannot not recognize myself in John. And that is also a fairly unusual situation mm-hmm. for like a character in comics to be at that level of need.
Do you think so?
Because
I think there are a lot of... If you look at, like, a lot of independent, quote-unquote, independent comics, there are a lot of small press independent comics that are not, like, superhero or kind of mainstream-based that deal with a lot of this stuff.
Yeah, there's a lot of autobio comics out there about dealing with depression and dealing with bipolar disorder and a whole slew of personal experiences with mental illness. Absolutely. Yes, I completely agree. Maybe I should restate it as the use of that as a component of a bigger story. That's not what I would have ever predicted would come out of this book in the first, I don't know, 3 or 4 issues.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
That it's not like Sex Criminals was touted as this, like, exploration of the raw ordeal of mental illness. I think that that's something that's coming about that adds to the depth of the other things happening in the story, so that now these characters have so much more at stake.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, now it's their relationship at stake.
Yeah, yeah.
Because really, if they don't step out of line anymore, then they're fine. You know?
Right. I mean, that, like, the issue with the sex police as a threat is obviously not gone. But
no, but if they don't steal or you know, cause mayhem anymore, then there's no consequences for them to be together. They're allowed to be together.
Right.
They're just not allowed to rob banks and, you know, like, destroy stores and cause general havoc.
I think that what we're seeing is, like, the consequences of something much more real that happens, like, in all of our lives, that was always there, that was always going to happen with Susie and John, completely independent of their ability to, like, fucking stop time.
Yeah.
And I think I hesitate to say pleasant surprise, because, like, for real, it is a hard and sad thing, but goddamn, it's so well done. Like, I really love this book, and I have from the beginning, but now I love it for, like, an entirely new slate of reasons.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. So now I feel like this was, like, the first issue for me where it was like, oh, I picked up a new series that I want to read about these people's relationship, and will they make it, and will they be able to deal with their inner demons to be together?
Yeah.
So, we'll see.
Ah, so much thinking, Myers. We should switch gears and do a whole bunch of laughing.
That's true. There's still thinking. There's talking.
Okay. You're right. You're right.
Yeah.
But there's also a lot of
laughing.
We're
not dummies. Yes. I think it's more fun talking to Jen Vaughn and talking about mental illness.
Well, I like fun things that are fun, and Jen is fun, and she's my new favorite, as you said. So why don't we switch gears entirely and speak with artist and designer and awesome kid extraordinaire Jen Vaughn.
Hi, this is Ashley at Ashley V. Robinson on the Twitter. Also, Andrea's Twitter girlfriend, so you should be able to find me on there if you follow her. Calling you with my nerd confession this week, which is which character we think most needs to go to therapy, unless I'm sorely mistaken. I think all of them, by definition, which is what makes dramatic characters interesting, is that they're flawed and full of problems. But since the whole point of this exercise is to pick one, I'm going to go ahead and say Tim Drake. Timothy Jackson Drake Wayne is my very favorite comic book character ever because he is sad. He is a walking bundle of emotional problems. Pretty much everybody he loves is dead. He doesn't cope well. He copes by being a professional and being increasingly efficient and cut off, you know, much in mirroring Bruce's idol. So I think he could probably use a couple good sit-down sessions with Daddy Bruce and Big Brother Dick, and they could kind of work out their issues and say that they love each other, and it would be really, really powerful. But that will never happen, because then I could never read any Robin or Red Robin or whatever the hell he's called in the DC Universe characters now. So that is my vote. Tim Drake Wayne seriously needs to go get some stuff off his chest. but I would really like to see him be therapized. I don't know what the right verb is. I haven't slept a lot. By Dr. Katz. So Tim Drake in therapy with Dr. Katz is my vote for this week. So I love you. Bye.
This week on the couch, we welcome cartoonist and designer Jen Vaughn. Jen has contributed to Adventure Time and Prince Liss and is part of the team doing Cartosia Tales, the all-ages anthology. Her book, Avery Fatbottom Renaissance Fair Detective, decidedly not all-ages, is published by Monkey Brain Comics. Jen also works in marketing and communications for Fantagraphics, and you may have seen her in Cartoon College, the documentary film about the Center for Cartoon Studies where she did her graduate work. Thanks for hanging out with us, Jen.
Thank you, Andrea and Aaron, for having me on the couch.
Aw.
No, absolutely. So let's start with a rundown of what you're currently working on, Cartosia Tales or other comics projects?
Absolutely. I'm currently scripting and thumbnailing Cartosia Tales 5. It's been quite a bit of fun, and but also there's a little bit, it's a little bit more collaboration than I'm used to, and I think that might be something we'll talk about later, but I'm definitely working on Cartosia Tales right now. I have a mentor, I guess you could say, in comics, Justin Norman, a.k.a. Moritat. Mm-hmm. He used to draw The Spirit and Elephant Men with Richard Starkings, as well as All-Star Western with Jonah Hex.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of a different field than where I'm coming from, because he's a mainstream cartoonist. But it's been great because I've done some ghost penciling with him a little bit and working with him. So we are doing some stuff currently, some pitches for Archie, actually.
Oh,
so,
cool.
That's been a lot of fun. I think I can say that. too late. And I have a couple other small projects that are here and there. And then Avery Fatbottom, I've been penciling issue 2. Took way too long, but, you know, there were a couple things I wanted to edit in, and I added a couple people from the Cartosia Tales Kickstarter into it. So,
nice.
As one of their fantastic rewards. I'm sure they wanted to be in a not all ages Renaissance fair comic.
That's really exciting news about Archie. I mean, that company has, they're just kind of like emerging, you know, as this juggernaut in a way of just, you know, great. Like getting all these great people to start working on Archie Comics and, you know, take all these kind of risks and different avenues with the characters. I don't know. It's a pretty exciting time for Archie.
They are definitely doing great things. And I'm glad Alex Segura is back with them because he had a brief stint back at DC Comics. But they haven't said yes to anything, but they also haven't said no to anything.
Mm-hmm.
So. It's a good place to be.
We just basically send them stuff over and over. So until, you know, wear them down.
Right.
So, yeah.
Wonderful.
Well, I think actually I want to talk about that wearing down thing, but maybe from a different perspective, because I want to talk about the fact that you work in the industry as your day job, but you're also a creator. And we've talked to other people who write about comics, but then also write comics. But I think that you're the first person that we've really spoken to who works strongly on the production side of things, but then is also creating. And I'm just curious if it's inspiring and like super exciting to be part of the process. And I'm sure you're learning a ton, but is there a danger of getting burnt out on comics while like also leaving less time to make your comics?
Oh, I definitely think you hit the nail on the head there, because as with anything, you definitely need like to be not necessarily well-rounded, but you know, have at least one other facet to your day. And I've definitely, Fantagraphics had a Kickstarter around November, December last year.
Right.
So it's actually been, like, I've been working, you know, some overtime and some other things. And that's definitely, like, cut into my comics making, unfortunately. But, I mean, for a good cause, and everyone that donated is going to get all their stuff. It's just, you know, some of it's a little late. And,
Well, it was a massive success, too.
Yeah, we got $250,000. So, mm-hmm. After Cartosia Tales and then some other fundraising I've done via classic means, you know, just throwing a party and whatnot that I did on the East Coast, it seemed like the next step, you know, adding some digits to that.
Like past bake sale, then you go
exactly.
Just, right.
Yeah, next we're going to, like, get new prison bars for the local prison. I don't know, something. But from old railroad ties, you know, it'll right. be like upcycling and fundraising.
Awesome.
I don't know why. Orange is the New Black season 2 just came out. I think that's why I mentioned prison. And I guess I do a lot of the marketing side of NPR for Fantagraphics books, like making sure that more people are aware of the books. Not that, you know, it's a, not that it's like a hard job, but it's necessarily like getting to look at the books in a different light. Some, you know, mm-hmm. using social media, some traditional means as well. And that's something I think that's kind of come easy to me in my own comics. So, and you know, everyone's got things that they want to work on. And sometimes mine is just getting my butt to stay down in the seat, because then, you know, I'll realize like I haven't been out of the house for a couple days. So I'm like, oh, I should probably go, you know, maintain a friendship with someone or something. And so, yeah, definitely the balance is always something you're working on. And I think I'm definitely getting better at it. But there's always room for practice and improvement.
Well, even on top of that, too, you've got the whole convention circuit that I'm sure eats up a ton of time this time of year, too.
Oh, yeah, I'm always bringing pages with me. I think last year at SPX, I was watercoloring a Halloween Adventure Time story, mm-hmm. and it was great because I actually spoke to Tyler. Oh, I wish I knew your last name. And he's a storyboarder for Bravest Warriors, Pendleton's other his cartoon hangover show. So he saw me working on it like two seats behind and was like, "What? Who are you?" And I was like, "I'm just a backup story artist, you know." But mm-hmm. it was kind of fun because, but then I'll take pages with me, and then like there'll be too much turbulence on a plane, or I'll just pass out because it's a midnight flight. So it's definitely like, when do you take your breaks? And, you know, planning for it. Like last night, I played Child of Light on PS3 and then South Park Stick of Truth for like 6 hours with my friends. So,
yeah. I think that's decompression time that has nothing to do with comics, though. You're exactly right.
Definitely. But then I was like analyzing storytelling too. I was like, why am I so attracted to these games and not other games? And I was like, okay, but yeah, it's everybody does that.
Yeah. I mean, that's just being in a creative field. You're probably always going to be breaking stuff like that down.
Yeah. I'm definitely still good at reading books and reading comics, though, without analyzing them too much. If I'm enjoying them, or I guess movies are the easiest ones, because I don't like think about like, and 45 minutes in, there's the little death. Now act 2 can begin. Mm. But with a book sometimes, yeah, I'm like breaking.
Do you find yourself analyzing like marketing and communication strategies of other creators or other publishers?
Oh yeah, for the Kickstarter stuff too, I'll have friends that will start one, and then I'll be like, why are you offering vanity flash drives? Like, I feel bad that it's like a flash drive with like their logo on it. And I was like, when people need a flash drive, they go out and buy one, the cheapest one they can find that holds the most room. Also, it has nothing to do with your comic about cavemen or something. Like, you know, it's like thinking things through. So it's like, I sometimes will contact people on the side and be like, you know, and I'm sure it's like, oh, you doing some unsolicited advice? Like, but I'm like, you know, it's painful to see, and like you want people to succeed, especially if they're talented and work hard, but maybe they just don't have that part of their brain kicking in at the right time.
Well, or they don't have experience with it on either a large or small scale. I think that at least just listening to friends of mine or friends of friends who have done Kickstarters in like even outside of comics, sometimes they don't do enough research into like what is successful, or they're really intimidated by the process. And then you get, you know, vanity, jump drives.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. the luxury item everybody wants to, pay for and then forget about for 30 days, so, which is my other thing. I always like I always forget when I'll kickstart like 4 things in a row and be like, oh shit.
Right, and they all pass, yeah. And you're like, oh, there's $150 I forgot about. You know?
But yeah. But then you get that like sweet honeybee honey from, you know, a local new apiary. So
that's wow,
that's quite a reward.
It is.
I need to expand my Kickstarter options.
Oh man, if you're not a true fatty, unless you're constantly searching at the food options that are local to you on Kickstarter.
Awesome.
I'm sorry, back on track.
No, we're on track. This is I'm just writing some notes down here for later. For kickstarting honey. All right. Stop that. All right, I guess we could talk about comics again.
Yeah.
Why start now?
Yeah.
Well, you're actually the first creator from Cartosia Tales that we've had a chance to speak to. And we both supported the project from the beginning. I think I supported it even earlier. I'm pre-Kickstarter on that.
You are, Aaron, and I knew that you were going to say that, or I would have scripted it for you, but I was just so confident that you were going to fit that in there.
You baited me, so you were expecting it.
Uh-huh.
I just want it to be known, you know, as pre-Kickstarter. PK on that.
Yep.
It's a really unique concept for all ages storytelling. But can you tell us a little bit about the process of working on such a fluid set of stories and characters and how that's different kind of from the way you approach your own storytelling?
Absolutely. And just in case no one knows, Cartosia Tales is an all ages kids anthology built around a shared map that myself and about 8 other creators, all under the editorial eye of Professor Isaac Cates, actually, I think he's a doctor, who teaches at the University of Vermont, in Vermont, as the name might suggest. And we built up this huge map with basically these two big islands with a couple little spits of other ones. And we created flora, fauna, a bunch of cryptids, basically like, you know, we were like, we don't want, you know, just dragons and unicorns. So we kind of made up some new ones. And we have each issue, we take the map, cut it into the 9 segments. So say I'll be in the top right-hand quadrant in the first issue. Then in the second issue, Lucy Bellwood will take over my story. So it's kind of, in a way, we are exploring the cartography through comics and teaching a little bit on the way. And then also it's collaborative storytelling. So it's a little bit more like playing Dungeons and Dragons or any of those games, like, what's the other one? Fiasco. Any sort of storytelling game where you have to rely on others, trust them, though, as well, and not be as precious with your work. And I think that's the hard part some of us have, or that is one of the things that is harder for us, is we're used to making comics until they are done and taking sometimes as much time as we need or as many pages. And in here, we're usually only dealing with 3 to 4 pages at a time due to the constraints of the book and printing and money.
Right.
And also, you know, we have to maintain that the characters will make the decisions that, you know, they should do. Or I guess staying true to their own personalities instead of what works well for the story. Because it is sort of a character-driven set of stories instead of plot in a way. And that's where I know I've come into trouble. Like, Isaac's like, I don't think that's how that character would do it. And I was like, well, I'm not using that character then, I guess. And we talk in our Muppet voices via email, apparently. But it's definitely been a lot of fun. It's just there's a lot of research, and sometimes you're like, I can't believe I did that much research for 4 pages of comics, you know, whereas like, you know, you'll be doing like 30 pages on your own in the same amount of time almost, but it's only you. You don't have to, but in the end, it's like you're becoming a stronger cartoonist and you're working with other people. And I think that's a big deal in comics as well. So it can be a very lonesome activity, and working with other people and strengthening bonds, because they kind of become your network. Same way with when I went to the Center for Cartoon Studies, like those people I can turn to and ask them to look at my comics or my thumbnails. And I know that they aren't going to, can I curse on this show?
Sure.
Yes.
Okay. Well, make sure they don't cunt coddle you. So they are definitely, you know, full blown, like, sometimes even like, why are you even making this story? It doesn't need to be told, you know, but it's obviously execution is the reason we'll watch like Westerns over and over, you know, it's with a different set of characters. So Cartosia Tales is great because it's definitely different than any other anthology I've ever been in. But it's still dealing, like, I'm super into fantasy, and I grew up on Piers Anthony's Xanth series, which always describes the women bust first. So, it's kind of fun to make strong female characters that aren't, I mean, not all of them were like that, but, you know, the majority. But, like, also, there's consequences to things in the series. It's not, we say all ages because it's not just for kids. It's like there's some layers going on and some jokes. I don't want to, I guess kind of like, you know, the first Shrek was surprising. There's a few jokes like that, I guess. I mean, not like, you know, like butts or anything, but.
No, we've talked a ton about the difference between things that are written for kids and things that are for all ages. I mean, we have probably 3 or 4 soapboxes at this point, but that's definitely the prominent one. And from the beginning, what I think was appealing for Aaron and I with that project But I was thinking, just in preparation for talking with you today, you guys have sort of, I don't know, like conjured up your own continuity. And that's another one of our soapboxes that we talk about, what having a shared universe can do to storytelling. But you've done it in a very like short-term creative way, so that you've got these intense bursts of storytelling with swapping characters and locations around that you have to be true to. But it actually seems like it's very, I don't know, almost liberating in a way, that you can explore things that fit within the world, but that that have that consistency to it.
You just pointed out something I never even thought about. It's like seeing a roommate you don't like anymore, but you have like 4 months left on your lease. Mm-hmm. You don't have to deal with those roommate/characters. That's a good idea. I need to think about like that. Oh man.
But you also, in a way, you have to think of the roommate who's going to move in after you too.
Right.
Oh God. Yeah. Yeah.
And it could be better. It could be worse.
I love everyone I work with on Cartosia Tales, which by the way, it's www.cartosia.com.
At Cartosia.
Oh yeah, yeah, exactly. Our Twitter handle. And Tom Motley, who is a cartoonist who teaches and instructor at like a school of visual arts in New York. I in issue 5, Isaac actually, another element of D&D, he actually rolls dice. Or picks our names out of a hat, depending on his mood, to figure out who's in what sector, as long as the sectors don't repeat. But sometimes you may follow a person you followed before and pick up their storyline. And Tom Motley contacted me because I was picking up his storyline for a second time for this current issue. And he was just like, he's like, if you want to like beg off, it's totally cool. I will not be offended. I don't even know why. I think it's because he's like a little bit more abstract than I am. So he's afraid, like, I don't know that I'm going to be like, what the hell's happening in this story? But I thought it was very, I thought it was so sweet for someone like I, you know, barely know. I met most of the people actually, but, or I've known like some of them for a long time, like Isaac or Lucy, but I just thought it was very sweet that he was just, yeah. And that's part of it. That's like, he's caring about me in a way that I'm not sure that like sometimes like an inker and a colorist at a, you know, a big two book might, you know,
right. Deal with those are more like, okay, I did my work. Now I move on to the next contract. This like, this has, because it's smaller, you have more kind of, there's more gravity to handing it off. You know,
exactly.
It's even if the stakes are equal or whatever, it's there's more, I think there's more concern because it's not a big kind of monolith where, all right, I did my job. I did what the contract says. I can move on.
Yeah, exactly. Do you guys read a lot of all ages comics?
We do. Well, can I speak for you, Aaron?
Sure.
Gosh, sorry. I have.
I will allow it at this point.
Thanks. I have an almost 9-year-old, and so I read all ages comics for his benefit, but also because I would rather read things with him than just hand things off to him that have no interest to me.
Exactly.
So we've
connect that way.
Right, exactly. And we've talked a lot. I think actually it's one of the first things that Aaron and I, like as friends, really bonded over is that like there's a need for access to stories at multiple levels. So like you mentioned Shrek, and Shrek is a great example of something that I would consider all ages, where maybe there are jokes that you get as an adult that are not inappropriate for younger kids, but they're going to access it at a different level of sophistication. And that's fine. That's why it's all ages. And it's not just like a Saturday morning cartoon that might be more traditionally appealing just to kids. So I think that's awesome.
Yeah, I definitely have been enjoying what Lumberjanes, Dexter's Lab, Adventure Time, all the, you know, like the current all ages stuff.
Mm-hmm. We do wish that there was a better word for it, though.
How about rad ages?
Something
ages, like
you just call them like all comics or something.
It's like as soon as you pinpoint something with a name, someone's like, oh, well, I don't want to be grouped in with that. So it's kind of there are party poopers everywhere. So
that's true. Just call them comics, and if they're appropriate, you read every comic and you just choose what's appropriate. Exactly. For your children. That's my approach.
Yeah. You have rose-colored glasses about it way more than I do, though.
Yeah, but there is a lot of books out there. It is a matter of discovery, and that kind of comes down to, I guess that, you know, this even goes back to Fantagraphics in a way, too. It's awareness, because, you know, Fantagraphics, I don't have to tell you, publishes some, you know, amazing books that I don't know if the general populace, and that's meaning, like, you know, people who have maybe access to one general comic book store, if they're lucky, would have, you know, any kind of awareness of, because it's a matter of the browsing ability.
I actually don't know this, Jen. Do Fantagraphics books show up in traditional bookstores?
They do. That was actually one of the big fights in the 80s and 90s that Gary Groff and Kim Thompson were working for, was to be accessible to the general public as literature and not just, like, funny books that are sad, you know?
Right.
Because I like to paraphrase sometimes that Fantagraphics makes ugly stories about ugly people. So, because you basically want an ugly story about a pretty person or a pretty story about an ugly person, but right. Sometimes, just sometimes.
You get a perfect storm.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a little real that way.
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, so we are in Barnes & Noble and some other bookstores. But as well as a lot of comic book stores. Because there'll be, like, you know, the graphic novel section. So there'll be First Second, Drawn and Quarterly, Top Shelf, and other imprints of bigger company, like the, you know, the Abrams Comic Arts and Penguin. So.
And, you know, we're both Pacific Northwest people that have stores that carry that kind of thing. But I don't know how prominent that is anymore, and, you know, in the rest of the country or the world. But there is accessibility. It's just a matter of awareness. And it goes the same thing about finding comics, you know, for your kids. I actually have friends or high school friends that, like, on Facebook, who know that I like comics, and it's been about a dozen people now, like, say, what should I get my kid? Mm-hmm. Because they don't know. You know, they go into a Barnes & Noble and they'll see a rack of trade paperbacks, but they don't know what's appropriate or not.
Yeah, the bigger box bookstores or whatnot, they've gotten better over... I actually worked at a Bookstop back in Austin, which is basically a Texas chain that got bought out by Barnes & Noble.
Uh-huh.
And we, at that time, had, like, Why the Last Man, and then, like, some younger, Spiral Bound by Aaron Rainier, like, you know, all grouped together along with, like, Chester Brown. First of all, I don't know how we had Chester Brown. Somebody, like, super loved him, but I was like, guys, we need to have a separate section.
Right.
We can't have these books right next to each other. Because the manga was already separated out by that point. Manga and romance books, by the way, are the most trash section of any bookstore, because nobody wants to be seen reading it. Or, in the case of manga, they'll just sit down there and read them and then never reshuffle them. In other places, yeah, like, there's a comic book store, I don't want to call them out, but it's in Dallas, Texas, where my mom lives, and I always, basically anytime I travel, I try to visit a comic book store and, like, say hello. I work at Fantagraphics, I also make comics, and, like, point out some stuff, and because then I'll email them back later, and, you know, they'll be like, hey, we, like, you know, put this on an end cap, and, like, send me a picture, and, like, create a better connection with them.
Mm-hmm.
But, and I went to the one, like, right next to my mom's house. I could walk to it. And I saw that they had Walker Bean by Aaron Rainier, speaking of, like, number one, but I was asking for number two, and the guy was like, what book? And because it was, like, you know, it was just, like, clumped in with all his graphic novels, but it was, like, it's, like, a great all-ages book, like, or YA or whatever, you know. And
you're right. And
he was just like, if it's not there, we don't have it. But, like, he wasn't even aware, and so I asked him, you know, if about X, Y, or Z, and then he even went on to say, he's like, well, I don't use the internet. And I was like, oh, I know you use the internet for work, though. He's like, yeah, but I don't read anything on it. And I was like, this is crazy. Mm-hmm. Like,
but that is not an uncommon story at all. Like,
yeah, I imagine that, like, if it happens there, it happens a million times over. So people are literally just going to read, like, certain franchises, basically,
mm-hmm.
because there are movies made out of them, or they want to read those same stories in different ways and see how the execution works.
Which is why when we talk about all ages books and, like, the need for accessibility, we always come back to the fact that we're talking to the same people about the same problem, and we're not solving the problem because we're almost, like, too insular with it. We talked to Allison Baker and Chris Robertson about this a couple weeks ago, and it comes back to our own experiences as parents, right? And what we want for our own kids and our, like, the friends of our kids. But We're not the problem. We know of these books. We're buying those books. Like, how do we educate and make it easier for people who don't, or who wouldn't even show up at a comic book shop, but who would stumble on it at a bookstore? You're asking a lot of an average shopper to just pick the right thing at a bookstore without any access to information about what is out there.
Well, I think this is where certain people come into play at very, you know, big air, like Petra Myers, NPR, or Dana Jennings from the New York Times. And it's like, these people will occasionally post lists. I know I'm forgetting people. I know I'm forgetting like a million people. Or Paul Constant, our local alt-weekly newspaper, The Stranger. Like, they will post lists of, you know, like upcoming YA comic books or all age, you know, and so that way people at least have a base. And it's going to be it's going to be like one book from each big publisher and like stuff that us in the industry have like already know about. It's like kind of like, well, no duh, like that's what you want. But it's for other people as a starting off point for them. Because, yeah, in a bookstore, you'll get someone who literally was just like, I bought Why the Last Man for my son. He loves it. I love it. What else do you have that's like this? You know, and it's like, it's definitely going. Well, I think those people, they help, those like media vector points and whatnot. Free Comic Book Day helps, honestly, because a lot of people that won't go to a comic book store will go on that day.
Because it's free.
And it's such a big event. And the Halloween Fest is pretty, they're like smaller version right around Halloween.
A lot of the libraries around us did Free Comic Book Day also.
Oh my gosh. Did they order from Diamond?
In the two that I'm aware of, they partnered with local shops, with local comic book shops, to make it more accessible. So I think that the libraries themselves weren't doing the ordering, but it was absolutely like the impetus of the children's librarians who happen to have a personal interest in it. Whoa. In both of those cases that I'm aware of. So I shouldn't say a lot of. I know of two specific examples, like in the Bay Area, that did that, and I thought it was fucking awesome. Because it was that much more present.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Yeah, I think that's the other thing is libraries are the places like librarians are pretty educated about it, honestly, getting more and more so thanks to like BEA, School Library Journal, Library Journal, those websites where you've got people like Martha Cornog who are writing about books and letting people know like here the age groups and whatnot. But it's also, you know, visiting them and talking to them and asking like, did you know about this series? Sometimes it just becomes, it's like a signal to noise ratio. Like if enough people start asking about a certain book that they want for their teen or them, you know.
Yeah, it hits a critical mass and then it breaks.
Yeah. Through. And then certain bookstore owners, it's like the ones that have kind of succeeded and done well, like Austin Books and Comics. It's like they made sure that they had separate well-marked sections for all their books so that you can find like, your image books versus your young adult books versus your like, you know, genre based manga and whatnot. Like they recognize that it's not all one giant like blob. And I think,
I mean, maybe it's partly too that there's a generation of store owners or store workers that have, you know, it's the same kind of people that say, oh, well, I don't read, you know, or I don't use the internet or something like that, you know, and they eventually will, you know, not be around.
Right.
And somebody else will take over that does. So maybe it's partly that too.
Yeah. I have a couple people working at Fantagraphics with me and we've been expanding our retailer directory. So, you know, we had like a list of like 400 shops and we took that and we're like, you know, checking all of them in all the states, you know, the biggest population centers. So then we can, you know, call and see, like, what's selling and do you, you know, sell mini comics there so we can have, like, a resource going. But also, but in that way, too, so we can see, like, you know, like, if it's mostly a superhero store, like, we, like, look at the market and it's, like, is it worth it to pursue more of a relationship with them? Or, you know, this store mentioned, like, a couple of our titles sold, so we probably want to send them some more stuff. So it's kind of just, you know, working on almost a grassroots level but still nationally to get what
it's like educating on both ends, right? It's like being more aware of it, of the market from your side, but also then like how can you tailor what you're doing for the market itself?
Exactly.
Well, we're talking a lot about Fantagraphics, but I'm kind of curious for your own books, do you take a look at this? And it's the kind of thing where it's the difference between creativity and marketing towards an audience. And I think they're both probably have to come into play if you're going to make a living in comics. You know, so is it good to have that perspective? Because when you're thinking about, okay, this is a series I want to write or draw or put out, and, you know, the mini comic market is probably pretty small, and it's still passion projects as opposed to livable wage projects. But at a certain point, you've got to consider that too, I'm assuming.
There are like a series of crossroads, I feel like, there that people find themselves with, and they'll have the passion projects, or someone recently called it a brain crack project. I'm trying to remember who said that. And it's like every time they see something, they're like, oh, I need to add that to my crack, like the crack in their brain that keeps expanding and expanding, and the thing that they'll never finish. But it's like, whereas something like with my like Avery Fatbottom comic that is going to be and has been plotted for 7 issues, even if it's slowly coming out, that I literally did just to make myself laugh. And I think that it's probably one of my more successful, at least, you know, in people reading it and responding, stories, because it was written mostly for me or people like me. And I did not, you know, I was like, you know, I didn't like show boobs, but then I was like, it's obviously not for, or penis. Hello. some sweet side scrote shots in there. didn't have that, but there's definitely like adult themes, because I was like, well, whatever, you know, like that's,
I mean, you haven't drawn them all. You can, there's still time.
There's, you know, there's going to be the village idiot in every Renaissance fair who's mostly just caked in mud and it cracks off at the right time.
There you go.
Yeah. There'll be a sweet rainstorm. But, yeah, I think but sometimes you just have to do things. You don't have to, but, you know, if you need rent money, you're going to take on a project that you're just going to draw or just going to write to make the money. Mm. But I think that just only thinking about the money when you're working on a mini comic, it comes out in the story.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
It'll be maybe the most, it'll be like a perfectly scripted story and everything's in the right place at the right time, like plot point wise, but then it'll just be lacking in heart.
Mm-hmm.
I went to school with a couple people that were really good at that, like planning out things, and like, but then there was like, you know, and everything was like just beautifully done on every level, except they didn't give a shit about it, and it was obvious when you were reading it, because you were just like, this felt whole but not complete in a weird way. So, and it's because they were like too scared to do their stories about like whatever, like I think it was circumcision in other countries, you know. Or something like,
is it sort of like, it's sort of like the uncanny valley of comic books then, you know, where it's almost a comic, it almost feels like a human wrote it, but there's something behind the eyes that just isn't right.
Exactly. Yeah. And then meanwhile you've got like those ones that people make like in 2 nights, and they're just, it's full, so full of frenetic energy, and like you can feel it like vibrating off the page, but then you're like, God, I wish they had maybe like redrawn this a time or two, or or knew how to draw it. No, there's definitely has to be that balance between like good writing and good art.
Right.
Because, well, I mean, so many people can draw, but if the story is boring, like, you know, you're going to forget it as soon as you're done. So,
Yeah.
So I want to talk about you specifically, right? Because you are who we're talking to. But I want to talk about your development kind of very prominently and publicly, partially because of the film Cartoon College, partially because you've been very active on Twitter, and then you also write for Fantagraphics on their blog. Do you think that that affects the perception of your work, or because you're more accessible as a person, do you ever get any weirdness from that? I'm curious about the balance between positive responses and then like potentially negative creeper ones.
I haven't had too many creepers, honestly.
That's awesome.
I was on another podcast, Robin McConnell's Inkstuds, like a while ago, with he and Brandon Graham sort of interviewed me, and that one was, they like, you know, because he'll ask for questions beforehand, and there was like a guy that kept emailing, and they're like, I must know, is Jen going out with someone? Sorry, I'm using an accent because...
obviously.
Because his name suggested it, and also the way he spelled, I don't, maybe he just was a 10-year-old kid who saw a picture, I don't know, but he like kept asking if I like had a boyfriend, and I was like, well, come on now, but you know, that's also potentially creepy. I try not to put myself in like situations where, like, I think dressing up in costumes is great and cosplaying is awesome, but because it's my industry I work in as an artist, I don't do it at shows. I do it for Halloween and when I go to movies, kind of. Like, it's
Did you used to?
Actually, not really, ever. When I would go to comic book shows, I would mostly just... But that was more like I didn't have enough money as like a teenager, probably. So I would just save it for Halloween or certain movies. Like when I went to see Dark Knight, I was a Two-Face in a pants or a skirt suit instead of a... And then I was Ozymandias when Watchmen came out.
Excellent.
And my then-boyfriend was Bubastis. It was really cool. I guess. I don't know. Maybe he's like being a cat, but I guess I don't have a lot of too much creepiness, but also I'm kind of a swarthy lady, so maybe they're just afraid, kind of have a don't fuck with me attitude, I think. So I think anyone of
that. I mean, that's probably a healthy kind of defense mechanism to build up as any kind of public person.
Yeah, yeah. I just think people know I could take them, so they don't really do it.
But what about the positive stuff?
The positives, I guess the positives are occasionally I'll be like at a pet food store or something and someone will be like, oh, aren't you a cartoonist? And that happened all the time in Vermont, but that was mostly because if you were under the age of 35 and you had like ink stained pants, they knew you weren't like a local. Or, you know, if you were just drinking a little bit too long at the coffee shop and drawing, they knew also that you probably didn't work at Dartmouth or were like a programmer or a farmer, because that's all there were there, basically. So I think that's kind of an interesting thing, running into people who know you, but you don't know. But, and then you usually say, like, I'm sorry, have we met? And they're like, oh, you know, I follow you on Twitter or I've read your comic, you know, and whatnot.
I saw you on a movie.
That's happened less, but it happened a few times. At some key moments when I was like on a date too, so it made me look really cool for that. I guess. But yeah, I guess maybe it being semi-public, like, you know, I have a mantra like never be sad or mad online, be funny or real. So, which I think most people have, but it means like if you're having a bad day, you just like, you can't really like let it out in any way that like some people use the internet for that aren't using it. They're using it more personally.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it's like, God damn, I wish I could do that. But, I don't want that to be out there and I don't want people to associate me with negative things, but also like if I'm maybe like running late on a project too, like Cartozzi Tales 4 or something, you know, then it's like better not use Twitter because Isaac and everyone else would be like, what the hell? You got time to like type in 140 characters on the toilet instead of finishing your comic, you know? So there's always that like management aspect that I kind of think of sometimes.
I mean, does that help? It depends on what kind of person you are, but does that help keep you on track with those sort of public pressures, you know, for deadlines, especially when it comes to, you know, Kickstarter projects where, I think it seems like with Kickstarters, there's a line where everyone's fine until you hit that line, and then it's immediately, where's my stuff?
Yeah.
You know? And there doesn't seem to be much of a buffer zone between it. And I always wonder for people who are heavily involved in the crowdsourced projects, like, where the pressure, if that pressure helps to complete it, or if it becomes more of a, like, kind of a, you know, a cloud hanging over your head.
Yeah, I'm not sure in the respect for, like, the Fantagraphics one, because sometimes it's just, like, you know, we had a T-shirt printer that decided not to print our shirts after they said they would, so they went with another one. So, like, you know, in the church, they just weren't there. Like, we had the designs.
Mm-hmm.
And then once we had them, everyone's like, hey, guys, it's all cool. But, you know, that was after, like, you pieces of wretch, I hope you die. And it's like, I'm the only one reading those messages. So it's kind of like... It's like I would literally like save some of those for the end of the day so I could just have a drink afterwards at a separate location, I feel like I should say.
Sure. Yeah, you switch venues for that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'd read them from my phone and kind of cry. and then, I'll, you know, just like, or people like it wouldn't be, you know, what they expect. But that's why they have like those suggested delivery dates. And like a third of those messages, people are like, where's my shit? And I was like, you haven't filled out your survey, so I don't have an address, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Or they're like, you know, this book's not out yet. And it's like, it's because it's not out until September of 2014, and it is still, you know, May or whatever. So it's just, you know, sometimes it's them not paying attention, and then sometimes it's just like, oh, we're not done. Like,
yeah.
But well,
in that case, it's also you as the face of the company as opposed to you like, so you have this, like, double layer of public persona that you have to negotiate there.
Yeah. Well, it's under a Gary Groth account, so most people think it's him. But if they get angry, I'm obviously, like, you know, I'm like, hey, Gary is actually, like, editing books. And, you know, this is, you're working with me. It's always been, you know, it's always been, but.
Pull back the curtain. It's always been me. It's been me the whole time.
I know. Yeah. Ha, ha, ha. Because, like, I spoke to Gary personally, and I'm like, oh, okay, I see where this is. Uh-huh. And I don't know if that's something we should have thought about beforehand, but I don't think it really matters other than, you know.
It is a constant kind of PR massaging of people, because it also goes to the nature of internet where, you know, taking the 10 money. Seconds, well, the 10 seconds to look to see what maybe the problem might be before you email is a hurdle that seems infinitely impossible for most people. I mean, probably myself included on a time or two, you know, where it's like, I could have just looked that up, but felt like sending an email instead and you know, ruining someone's day or something.
Because you're kind of a terrible person.
Well, yeah, I mean, but I am a general representation of the internet.
Also, you're a robot.
Yes. Oh, did you pass the Turing test the other day?
I did.
Talked about this week, actually. Yeah,
I was talking with a friend about this, and we kind of were, like, wondering if that was bullshit or not, because
yes,
the people that were they were being tested with, the judges, were any of them of that age range, 13-year-old boys?
I think they're
not to my understanding.
Because I think another teen could sniff out a fake teen.
Also, the fact that it was a non-native speaker, teenager, like, there's just so many convenient parameters to apply to it to make it work. It just, it's totally bullshit.
I was just like, did science need a new headline? I mean, Jesus, it's already the coolest thing on earth right now. Like, you know, it's no longer cool to be a jock, obviously, because you lose so many brain cells.
Yeah, but everyone's talking about, like, climate change and, like, all this nature stuff. It's time to get back to computers taking over the world. We need to get that back in the news.
Let's get back to passing notes under a door and not knowing who's pushing them back.
Yeah. The important things in life.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, let's talk about life in the future. And this is the job interview portion of the of the interview. It's very meta, I guess. So what's your 5-year plan as an artist and a writer? And, you know, bigger picture, where do you think the industry needs to be to achieve that?
Wow.
No pressure, simple question.
I think the industry is moving in the right direction with books made in print and digitally for all ages, specific ages. You know, in Avery Fatbottom, I tried to get Comixology to put in music because I had, like, a body wenching song that I wanted people to know the melody of so they could sing it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they said, Jen, give us 6 months and we can do it. And I was like, well, it's supposed to come out in 2 months. So I put in a link to a Flickr account of me poorly singing it.
Can I just interject, because it just came into mind because of that? Because Lumberjanes, I think, did it very cleverly.
Yes, they used the QR code. And I was, like, so pissed. But I was like, honestly, QR codes are on ketchup, you know, so they...
Yeah, it was kind of brilliant. I'm like, this actually is awesome. I can use my phone, play the song, and get back to the comic, you know, right afterwards.
I thought it was great. I would not have used so much space, but I realized, you know, it's a comic that they're kind of trying to push out at a monthly rate. Uh-huh. But yeah, I thought it was actually, it wasn't Lumberjanes, it was Bee and Puppy Cat.
Oh, that's what I mean, sorry.
Yeah, that's okay. I also just read that. And yeah, that's when I was like, oh, I should have used the QR code. But then I was like, well, you know, I mean, it doesn't matter. Like, it was super cool. And I think it's like interactivity, but at low cost. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Because there are a couple, I went to South by Southwest Interactive for a couple years, and there were these things, like the multi-platform storytelling, like all this stuff where they'd, you know, you'd like, I can't remember the books they were, but it would be like a horror book.
And you would sign up. The company, like, Madefire? They do a lot of that.
I think so. Is that it? God, I hope so. I'm going to write it down. Where you'd, like, you know, you'd sign up, you'd give them, like, money for the book and a little bit extra, and you'd give them, like, your phone number and your email address and your home address so they could come and kill you.
Wow, that is interactive.
That is the end of the book. Yeah, no. But they would, like, you know, at some point you would get an email, like, and they'd be like, on page 21, like, if you'd read up that far, like, you know, use this cipher to decode something. And then you would actually, like, go to a website then and enter it. And, you know, there'd be all this really cool stuff.
No, that's not Madefire. Just if you're writing this down, that's not Madefire. Okay. Madefire is like a whole separate app and a whole separate platform that's fucking awesome.
Okay.
Way more interactive and way more like immediate than that. That's okay. You're describing something that sounds almost like a choose your own adventure reading process, which is also cool.
I don't think Rob Zombie had anything to do with it, but it felt like something he was part of because it was like, you know, somebody would call your fucking house and leave like a answering machine message and it'd be like, and you'd be like, I'm being stalked. And you're like, oh, wait, it's that thing I signed up for 6 months
ago.
That's
crazy.
Like,
was that movie like The Game or something like with Michael Douglas?
Oh, God. Yeah.
You know, where rich people signed up for it and they kind of, you know, they take over your life. That's the comics version of that.
Exactly. That's how I feel with Welcome to Night Vale. I love listening to that, but only like in these certain neighborhoods in Seattle, like while walking someone else's dog, like because it's so leafy and dark, it's like Green River Killer territory, and like a cat will slink out of the shadows, and you're like, ah, or you know, every dark doorway is gorgeous, and it's like just enough to scare me when I'm listening to it. And then I tell my friends, like, I'm like, here's how you need to listen to it. And they're like, Jen, if you want to be scared, just tell us where you are and we'll come and like bang on your windows at night, you know. Like, no, it's like a controlled, you know, sense of, but yeah, that sort of interactivity is something that I think I kind of wanted to do it on a local level at some point. And like back when I was in Vermont, like do a like a 3-part comic and leave it in different areas of town, but provide a map so that kids would have to kind of like, but with, you know, so it'd be like to sponsor or, you know, get local businesses in on it. Like maybe people get like a discount everywhere.
Like a geocache comic mashup.
Yes, I also geocache and have made
you're adorable.
So those I've never put online, but I should.
Like, yes, please do.
It's great because, yeah, geocaching, it's like, for those who don't know, it's a geolocation-based scavenger hunt using your phone. Back in the day in like the 70s, you had to use like weird maps and like a Garmin GPS. And
yeah,
like
your topo maps and your...
Exactly.
Yeah, go on and your bulletin board service.
Longitude and latitude.
Exactly. And now we have Groundspeak, the like the number one app for it, made geocaching. And now they, oh, man. And they can happen anywhere. Like in one of my comics, we're explaining sort of, I have like these two characters, like Pilar and I can't remember the other girl's name. Was it Andrea? Anyway, maybe it was Andrea.
It's a great name.
It's a great name. I should keep running with that. Oh, you know what? It was Mabel. Totally similar, though. But they actually find a geocache and someone's about to give birth. And they're like leaning against the tree it's in. And they're like, well, later. But, you know, it could be anywhere. And there's one in Seattle. It's in front of, it's on the Google steps. And I have yet to complete it because you actually need a Garmin. You have to, or a longitude and latitude, like a moving GPS system because it's one of those multi-caches. Mm. But it's like 6 long. Or wait, yeah, 6. I think it spells out Google. But it's like, there's the warning is like, they're like, be careful. There are plainclothes detectives out here or bodyguards making sure you're not attacking Google. So they're like, do not get on your hands and knees and search for it. Like sit down on the steps and kind of like tie your shoe and just reach to the spot around where it should be, you know, like play a game on your phone. Like there's all these things that are like, so I'll check in with you guys and let you know when I've done the Google one finally.
And if we don't hear from you, we know it didn't go so well.
Please come find me. I'll be in a primary colored prison.
Well, to get back to the question though, I mean, I guess that kind of goes into it. Is that part of it? Like taking comics to the next level?
In some ways, but in some ways it's just making good stories too. Like that will never, that's the same thing with music. It's like you can invent different ways to make noise, different ways to listen to noise or watch noise. Like if you're using like that special fog to make music or whatever I saw in the science program recently. But it's more about also just making good stories. Like at some point, and maybe this is something as you get older, it's like you want to see something where you see the setup of a story in like a book trailer or a movie preview, but you want a story where you just can't figure out the ending until you're watching it or reading it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times it's like you can figure it out because maybe their clues are too similar or it's just something you've seen before. And if you're an immortal like me, you've seen everything.
Right.
but yeah, I guess for my plan, I'd like to obviously have Avery Fatbottom done. And then also have a couple, I'm working on some all ages stuff that's currently secret right now, but will hopefully be announced later this year. And that's something I want to be slightly long term, or at least 10 issues. So I guess just a I guess I just like to be continue to be working in comics, though, making them, collaborating with people whom I trust.
Making them awesome.
Make them, oh, thank you. Oh, let's see. Right. That's right. And still making them on some form of paper, too. I'm a little old school that way. Like I, but it can be like that book in Inspector Gadget that Penny has, you know. You know what I'm talking about?
Yes.
The, okay, the her computer book. Or from Neal Stephenson's The Diamond Age.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God. Or,
yeah,
you're the best.
Yeah. When isn't the BBC supposed to be making a short series out of that book?
Yes, they've all been optioned, but I don't think anything has actually moved forward with that.
Yeah, but that would be that those books would be fine. You know, basically an iPad, but with some physical pages with different,
totally.
You know, easier to break. So,
well, okay. So speaking of awesome, this is the part where I have to acknowledge that Allison and Chris of Monkey Brain put us in touch with you because they're rock stars, right?
Oh,
and
yeah.
Chris specifically told me that I have to ask you about the Dalai Lama story. So let's head towards wrapping up this fabulous conversation, but like, please don't leave me hanging. I really, my curiosity is piqued. What is the Dalai Lama story?
Well, everyone's met a famous person, but I have once met the famous person, the Dalai Lama. When I was attending the University of Texas in Austin, I used to volunteer with Voices for Choice, which is sort of like Planned Parenthood Junior, sort of. Mm-hmm. We'd like educate people about, you know, accessible birth control, Plan B, and, you know, women should have a right to their own body and choices, all that good stuff. Comprehensive age-appropriate sex education, my other favorite thing. And so I was going to set up that table that day out on the student quad. So I was like walking across the street, and then all of a sudden this cop on a bicycle stopped me and like stopped a bunch of other people, and like they waved through like 10 giant SUVs, and I saw like a little crimson and gold flash by, and I was like, oh, that's right, like the Dalai Lama had been at the campus the previous day. But I had classes to go to, so I couldn't go because people waited like 3 days for tickets. They like slept slept outside the ticket office, all that good stuff. So I went and set up, and of course I'm like right next to the Young Conservatives of Texas in their Dockers and denim shirts. And so I set up the table, and then all of a sudden I see this like six squadron, I don't know what they're called, but six suits walking towards me, and in the middle is a much smaller man, a bald man in crimson and gold. I'm like, oh my God, it's the Dalai Lama. And so I just like make eye contact, smile brightly, and wave, and he waves over to me and says something to the suits, and they all just start coming towards me. And then he comes up to the table, and you know, we exchange pleasantries, and then he looks down and he says, oh, are these for sale? And I look down, and it's like cola flavored condoms, strawberry kiwi lubricant, like grape dental dams. I'm sure he has no idea what the hell those are. In addition to like how to talk to your like senator, representative, etc. pamphlets. And I was like, oh no, these are free. And I was just like, do you want some? And in the back of my head, I'm like, he's celibate. He is totally celibate. But I was like, you know, you can't.
Those are delicious flavors.
Exactly. You know, I was just like, we've all, you know, not had enough rent money and just been like, I just need a little sugar. So some of that lube could probably, you know, make that make me feel like I'm eating ice cream. And he said, no, thank you. But was very sweet. Meanwhile, the Young Republicans on my left are like spitting on the ground near my feet. They can't believe what I just did. So, and then he goes and he just talks to each table and is very nice. And I was just like, well, that was, you know. At least he was offered, you know? He could have given them to some friends, maybe a gift bag for next time someone goes to visit him.
Sure, yeah.
But that is my Dalai Lama story.
That is amazing.
Wonderful. So, well, thank you so much for talking with us today, Jen.
Absolutely. Thank you, guys. I had a great time.
You'll be at San Diego Comic-Con, yes?
Yes. And I'll be at the Fantagraphics booth, which I think is 1718. Same one. We're always right by like top shelf slave labor graphics, Drawn and Quarterly. So in this sort of, please come and see me. I have pink bangs, or I even have like Neapolitan ice cream colored hair. So brown, white, and pink. So.
And the dog will be with you?
The dog will not be with me.
Oh, okay. So we can't spot you that way.
Yeah.
The bangs will do it.
Actually, I was at the line work show a couple months ago, and you're very easy to spot because obviously you're at the Fantagraphics booth, but if you follow you on Twitter or anything, you are the same in real life.
Oh, thank you. Actuality.
Yes. So I can attest that people will be able to spot you.
Good.
Well, just as a reminder to everyone else, thanks for joining us, and don't forget to pre-order your comics at your local shop or subscribe to them digitally. Show notes and other details are on our site, as always, comicstherapy.com. We'll see you next week.
Life is hard, and so am I. You better give me something so I don't die.